The inundation of the Nile was at its height, and the lands along the river were in the fecund embrace of the river. As she had done every season from the beginning of time, she was laying down on our fields another rich layer of black silt. When she receded again, those glistening expanses would once more bloom with that shade of green that is peculiar to this very Egypt. The rich silt and the sunshine would raise three crops to harvest before the Nile poured over its banks once more to deliver its bounty. The borders of the flooded fields were hemmed with the raised dikes that controlled the flood and also served as roadways. I followed one of these footpaths eastward until I reached the rocky ground along the foothills. Then I turned southward. As I went, I paused occasionally to turn over a rock beside the path until I found what I was looking for. Then I struck out with more determination. I kept a wary eye on the rough and broken ground on my right-hand side, for that was just the type of terrain that would afford a fine ambush for a band of shrikes. I was crossing one of the rocky ravines that lay across the pathway when I was hailed from close at hand. "Pray for me, beloved of the gods!" My nerves were so tightly sprung that I had let out a startled cry and leapt in the air before I could prevent it. A shepherd boy sat on the edge of the ravine just above me. He was not more than 10 years old, but he seemed as old as man's first sin. I knew that the shrikes often used these children as their scouts and their sentinels. This grubby little imp looked perfect for that role. His hair was matted with filth, and he wore a badly tanned goatskin that I could smell from where I stood. His eyes were as bright and as avaricious as those of a crow as he ran them over me, assessing my costume and my baggage. "Where are you headed, and what is your business, good father?" he asked, and blew a long warbling note on his reed flute that could have been a signal to somebody hidden further up the hillside. It took another few moments for my heart to steady its wild pace, and my voice was a little breathless as I told him, "You are impertinent, child. What business is it of yours, who I am or where I go?" Immediately he changed his demeanour towards me. "I am starved, gentle priest, an orphan forced to fend for myself. Don't you have a crust for me in that big bag of yours?" "You look well nourished to me." I turned away, but he scrambled down the bank and danced beside me. "Let me see in your bag, kind father," he insisted. "Alms, I beg of you, gentle sir." "Very well, you little ruffian." Out of the bag I brought a ripe date. He reached out for it, but before his fingers touched it, I closed my hand, and when I opened it again, the date had been transformed into a purple scorpion. The poisonous insect lifted its tail menacingly over its head, and the boy screamed and fled back up the bank. At the top he paused only long enough to howl at me, "You are not a priest! You are one of the desert jinn! You are a devil, not a man!" Frantically he made the sign against the evil eye and spat three times on the ground, and then he raced away up the hill. I had captured the scorpion from under a flat rock further along the path. Naturally I had nipped the sting from the end of its tail before slipping it into my bag in readiness for just such an eventuality. The old slave who had taught me to read lips had showed me a few other tricks while he was about it. One of them was sleight of hand. At the shoulder of the next hill I paused to look back. The shepherd boy was on the crest far above me, but he was not alone. There were two men with him. They stood in a group looking down at me, and the child was gesticulating vehemently. As soon as they saw I had spotted them, all three of them disappeared over the skyline. I doubted they would want further truck with a demon priest. I had not gone much further when I saw movement on the track ahead of me, and I stopped short and shaded my eyes against the dazzle of the noonday sun. I was relieved to make out a small and innocent-seeming party coming in my direction. I moved forward cautiously to meet it. And as we drew together, my heart leapt as I thought I recognized Tunnus. He was leading a donkey. The doughty little animal was heavily burdened. Atop the large bundle on its back sat a woman and a child, but it trotted on gamely. I saw that the woman was herself heavily burdened, her belly swelling out with her pregnancy. The child balanced behind her was a girl on the verge of puberty. I was about to hail Tunnus and hurry forward to meet him when I realized that I was mistaken, and the man was a stranger. It was his tall, broad-shouldered figure, the limber way he moved and the shining shock of gold-blonde hair that had deceived me. He was watching me suspiciously and had drawn his sword. Now he pulled the donkey off the path and interposed himself between me and the precious burden it carried. "The blessings of the gods upon you, good fellow," I played out my role as priest, and he grunted and kept the point of the sword aimed at my belly. No man trusted a stranger in this very Egypt of ours. "You risk the life of your family on this road, my friend. You should have sought out the protection of a caravan. There are brigands in the hills." I was truly worried for them. The woman seemed gentle and decent, while the old child was on the verge of tears at my warning. "Pass on, priest," the man ordered. "Keep your advice for those who value it."
"You are kind, gentle sir," the woman whispered. "We waited a week at Quenna for the caravan and could no longer wait. My mother lives at Luxor, and she will help with the birth of my baby."
"Silence, woman," her husband growled at her. "We want no truck with strangers, even though they wear the robes of the priesthood." I hesitated, trying to fathom if there was anything that I could do for them. The girl was a pretty little thing, with dark obsidian eyes, and she had quite touched my heart. However, at that moment, the husband urged the donkey past where I stood, and with a helpless shrug, I watched them go. "You cannot bleed for all of mankind," I told myself, "nor can you force your advice on those who reject it." Without looking back again, I went on northwards. It was late afternoon before I looked down on the spur of rock that thrust out into the green swampland. Even from this vantage point, it was impossible to pick out the shanty. It was hidden deep in the papyrus beds, and the roof was of papyrus stems, so the concealment was perfect. I ran down the path, leaping from rock to rock until I reached the edge of the water. This far from the main course of the Nile, the flood was not so significant. I found our old dilapidated boat tied up at the landing. It was half flooded, and I had to bail it out before committing it to the water. I pulled out cautiously along the tunnel through the papyrus. At a low ebb of the Nile, the shanty stood on dry land, but now there was sufficient water under the stilts that supported it to drown a standing man. There was an empty boat, in better shape than mine, tied to one of the hut stilts. I moored mine beside it, climbed the rickety ladder, and peered into our old hunting lodge. It consisted of a single room, and the sunshine streamed in through the holes in the thatched roof. But no matter, for it never rains in Upper Egypt. The hut had not been in such disorder since the day Tanos and I had first discovered it. Clothing and weapons and cooking pots were scattered around like the debris of a battlefield. The stink of liquor was even more powerful than that of old food and unwashed bodies. Those unwashed bodies were lying on an equally unwashed mattress in the far corner. I crossed the littered floor gingerly to inspect them for signs of life, and at that moment the woman grunted and rolled over. She was young, and her naked body was full and enticing, with big round breasts and a thatch of crisp curls at the base of her belly. However, even in repose, her face was hard and common. I had no doubt that Tanos had found her on the waterfront. I had always known him to be fastidious, and he was never a drinking man. This creature and the empty wine jars that were stacked against every wall were merely an indication of how far he had been brought down. I looked at him now as he slept and hardly recognized him. His face was mottled and bloated with drink and covered with untrimmed beard. It was clear that he had not shaved since last I had seen him outside the harem walls. At that moment the woman woke. Her eyes focused on me, and in a single cat-like movement she was off the mattress and reaching for the sheathed dagger hanging on the wall beside me. I snatched the weapon away before she could reach it and offered her the naked point. "Go," I ordered softly, "before I give you something in your belly that even you have never felt before." She gathered up her clothes and pulled them on hurriedly, all the while staring at me venomously. "He has not paid me," she said, once she was dressed. "I am sure you have already helped yourself generously." I gestured towards the door with the dagger. "He promised me 5 rings of gold. She changed her tone and began to whine. "I have worked hard for him these last 20 days or more. I have done everything for him, cooked and kept his house, serviced him, and cleaned up his puke when he was drunk. I must be paid. I will not leave until you pay me." I seized her by a lock of her long black hair and ushered her to the doorway. I helped her, still by means of her hair, into the more dilapidated of the two boats. Once she had poled out of my reach, she turned upon me such a stream of abuse that the egrets and other waterfowl were frightened from the reed beds around us.
When I returned to where Thanos lay, he had not moved. I checked the wine jars. Most of them were empty, but there were still two or three that were full. I wondered how he had accumulated such a store of liquor, and guessed that he had probably sent the woman back to Karnak to find a ferryman to ship it out to him. There had been enough to keep the entire corps of the Blue Crocodile Guards drunk for a season. Little wonder that he was in such a condition. I sat beside his mattress for a while, letting my sympathy for him run its full course. He had tried to destroy himself. I understood that, and did not despise him for it. His love for my mistress was such that without it, he did not wish to continue living. Of course, I was also angry with him for abusing himself in such a fashion and for succumbing to such self-indulgent folly. However, even in this pitiful drink-sodden state, I could still find much that was noble and admirable about him. After all, he was not alone in guilt. My mistress had tried to take poison for the very same reason as he had tried to destroy himself. I had understood and forgiven her. Could I do less for Thanos? I sighed for these two young people, who were all that I had in the life of any real value. Then I stood up and got to work. Firstly, I stood over Thanos for a while, bolstering my anger to the extent that I could be really harsh with him. Then I took him by the heels and dragged him across the floor of the hut. He came half out of his stupor and cursed weakly, but I took no notice of his protests and tumbled him through the doorway. He plunged into the swamp head first and raised a mighty splash as he went under. I waited for him to come up and flounder about groggily on the surface, still only half conscious. I dropped in beside him, grabbed a double handful of his hair, and thrust his head back under water. For a moment he struggled only weakly, and I was able to hold him under with ease. Then his natural instincts of survival took over, and he heaved up with all his old strength. I was lifted clear of the surface and thrown aside like a twig in a storm. Thanos came out bellowing in the effort to draw breath and striking out blindly at his unseen adversary. One of those blows would have stunned a hippopotamus, and I backed away hurriedly and watched him from a distance. Coughing and choking, he floundered to the ladder and hung upon it with his hair streaming into his eyes. He had obviously swallowed so much water and sucked so much of it into his lungs that I felt a tingle of alarm. My cure might have been a little too vigorous. I was just about to go to his aid when he opened his mouth wide and a foul mixture of swamp water and rotten wine erupted out of him. I was astonished by the quantity of it. He hung on to the ladder, gasping and gurgling for breath. I swam to one of the stilts of the hut and waited until he had vomited again before I told him, putting all the contempt I could muster into my voice, "My Lady Lostris would be so proud to see you now." He peered about with streaming eyes and focused on me at last. "Tater, damn you! Was it you that tried to drown me, you idiot? I could have killed you. In your present condition, the only damage you could do would be to a jar of wine. What a sorry, disgusting sight you are!" I climbed the ladder into the hut and left him in the water, shaking his head and mumbling to himself. I set about tidying up the mess and the filth. It was some time before Thanos followed me up the ladder and sat shamefacedly in the doorway. I ignored him and went on with my work, until at last he was forced to break the silence. "How are you, old friend? I have missed you." "Others have missed you also. Kratos, for one. The squadron has been fighting downriver. They could have found use for another sword. My Lady Lostris, for another. She speaks of you every day and holds her love pure and true. I wonder what she would think of that trollop I chased out of your bed." He groaned and held his head. "Oh, Taita, don't speak your mistress' name. To be reminded of her is unbearable. So broach another jug of wine and wallow in your own filth and your self-pity," I suggested angrily. "I have lost her forever. What would you have me do then?" "I would want you to have faith and fortitude, as she has." He looked up at me pitifully. "Tell me about her, Taita. How is she? Does she still think of me?" "More is the pity," I grunted disgustedly. "She thinks of little else. She holds herself ready for the day that you two are brought together again." "That will never be. I have lost her forever, and I don't want to go on living." "Good," I agreed briskly. "Then I'll not waste further time here. I'll tell my mistress that you did not want to hear her message." I pushed past him, swarmed down the ladder, and dropped into the skiff. "Wait, Taita," he called after me. "Come back." "To what purpose? You want to die? Then get on with it. I'll send the embalmers out to pick up the corpse later.